My name is Megan Lloyd-Laney. I've been working in this field for longer than I would care to describe, and I have come across extraordinary, passionate, and capable people who are doing very good work around research uptake. And we thought it was good to be able to share the conversations that we are able to have with those people about what they do and how they do it. So that's the prompt for a cup of tea with. Today, I will interview Saskia Gent, who is a director and long-time advocate of uptake, both in the global development field and in the UK environment. Saskia has worked for a long time in this field. She is currently director of Insights for Impact, a new initiative, and I'm sure she'll say a couple of things about it when we start speaking. She was head of research quality and impact for 2 years at the University of Sussex, research excellence framework impact officer for a year before that. So she's well versed in both the global and the UK setting of how you go about to optimize the uptake of evidence. Saskia, how did you get here?
So as you said, I've recently launched a consultancy, which is called Insights for Impact. I've used the impact word because I'm expecting to work mainly with higher education institutions and researchers in those organisations for whom impact is the kind of the big buzzword. It's the big sort of thing that's motivating people, new people perhaps, to do some of this work at the moment, working in journalism, research and product development. I went back to university to do a master's and never really left. This was in the days when DFID had just begun to fund a new set of research centres, what they were calling development research centres. And they'd just funded the Development Research Centre on Migration, Globalisation and Poverty. And that was funded from 2003, one of the earliest centres of that type to be funded. And even DFID, who we think of as being very much at the forefront in funders in terms of kind of enabling research uptake, there wasn't much discussion of it in those days. So I was appointed as a policy officer with the objective of kind of engaging policymakers in the UK and also supporting our international partners in their policy work. But interest in research uptake had ramped up massively during the life of that research centre. And I think of 2009 as being a really pivotal year for research uptake, particularly in the UK. By then, DFID was requiring research centres to set aside 10%, at least 10%, and they'd certainly had an ambition in those days to increase it up to 30%. But 10% of the research funding was expected to be ring-fenced for research uptake work. And so that was a really big change, and it was a really useful tool, I think, to enable researchers and research centres and to ensure that they were paying proper attention to this sort of work. But also in 2009, Pathways to Impact were introduced by the research councils. So that's the mechanism that they use for encouraging researchers to begin to think about research uptake at the beginning of their funded projects. And also, the other funding body in the UK, HEFC, was piloting their REF case studies in 2009. So that was a really big year for this sort of work to take off. So having worked for the Migration Centre that DFID funded, I then moved over to work with researchers in the School of Global Studies, so anthropology, international relations and geographers, working on research communications, developing impact strategies, working on their pathways to impact for funding and so on. And that evolved into working on their narrative case studies as the government's assessment of researchers' impact came closer. And after my experience doing that, I was seconded to work over in the Central University and oversaw the complete submission of the university's case studies. So I had to read 73 case studies describing impacts from everything from history to physics. So that was a massive intellectual challenge and one I enjoyed very much.
How would you define research uptake in layperson's terms, a couple of sentences, what you mean by it when you introduce yourself to researchers?
Well, I guess that I am thinking about the kind of beneficial effects that research can have in society. And as we know, it's extremely difficult to predict how that is going to happen. So I think probably the biggest collection of case studies about how research gets taken up and used and creates benefit is in the UK's REF case study database, which is a really fascinating collection of the 7,000 stories of benefit, and they are kind of success stories, so they perhaps need to be taken with a pinch of salt. But there are 7,000 stories in there of how impact, how research has created societal benefit. An analysis of those 7,000 case studies has shown that there are about 3,500 different pathways in there. That's what I'm thinking about when I talk about research uptake, is the numerous different pathways that researchers can take, the relationships that they engage in, all the different sorts of building blocks, whether it's your communications, your engagement, and how those steps lead to impact. And of course, you know, quite often that can be serendipitous. It doesn't have to be something that you've planned.
So uptake, in answer to Sylvia's question, how we define research uptake, it's defined differently by different bodies. So for example, ODI would define it one way, DFID defines it a different way, IDRC might define it. Using slightly different words, it's about how to optimize the accessibility and usefulness and utility of a body of evidence. And as you say, Saskia, it's then what are the processes that help us not get that done, because we don't have control over it necessarily, but what can we do to optimize the chances of that happening?
I think that leads on quite well to my first top tip. And I'd say that these top tips aren't necessarily, there aren't always things that, you know, as somebody who's working in research uptake, we have complete control over. But I think, you know, if I was, you know, going to take up a new research uptake role, I'd certainly hope to work in an environment which allowed me to do some of these things. So my suggestion that planning early and well is important, you know, I'm thinking about this in quite holistic terms. So you'd also might want to think about working with, you know, the sorts of people that you're working with, those people who do have those sorts of change ambitions, and a commitment to the sort of broad range of activities that are required for research uptake success, and perhaps have very good networks, which I think are all useful. Too often researchers still see research uptake as something that they can do at the end of a project. So they've acquired their findings, neatly packaged them, and then try and present them to people who they think might be able to use them. And of course, then the questions are from policymakers who say, well, that's all very well, but it would have been fantastic if only you could have asked X, Y, or Z question early on, and then the research would have been extremely useful.
And then your second point is to enable you to do that, you actually need to make sure that even before then, you've put some resources in
Absolutely.
Place.
Absolutely. I think that some researchers could perhaps benefit from building networks of intermediary organisations. Sometimes researchers, I think, feel that they need to be able to do everything themselves. But if they could build networks of other people with complementary skills or with different networks, that reach into different areas, and those things are put into the project planning, I think that's the sort of thing that can make your research uptake planning much more effective. Fundamentally, a lot of the change that we see in this area is underpinned by personal relationships, and I think that's something that's massively underestimated in planning for and assessing how these things happen. And in fact, one of my recommendations is a couple of readings from the N8 Research Consortium in the north of England, which is really unpicking co-production and really looking at what are the barriers to properly working together and properly having kind of a partnership of equals in that sort of relationship. I am optimistic, as my fifth tip says, that things are gradually moving in the right direction in that sense. More institutions, for example, are allowing promotions criteria to include this sort of work.
Point four, just say very quickly something about what you mean by that and maybe an example.
Well, I like the idea of, you know, obviously people are horizon scanning, they're looking at the different policy processes that are happening, but also I think you need to be ready for, you know, a door to open unexpectedly. And that might include, I mean, you know, developing your elevator pitch of what it is that you would like to see happen and how you'd like change to happen. Perhaps writing, you know, in an ideal world, what is the policy briefing that you'd like to deliver to X person, or light a match and before the match, and you're not allowed to let go of the match until you've kind of encapsulated, you know, one action that you want your key stakeholder to take.
Saskia, thank you so much. Nice
thank
to
you, Megan.
have a cup of tea with you, and look forward to speaking again.
Thanks a lot. Bye.